In Aeneid Book 12, line 442. When Aeneas had finished speaking, he moved through the gates in all his massive might, brandishing his huge spear, and there rushed with him in serried ranks Antheus and Menestheus and all his escort, streaming from the camp. A blinding dust then darkened the plain. The very earth was stirred and trembled under the drumming of their feet. As they advanced, Turnus saw them from the rampart opposite. The men of Ausonia also saw them, and cold tremors of fear ran through the marrow of their bones. But before all the Latins, Juturna heard the sound and knew its meaning. She fled, trembling, but Aeneas came swiftly on, leading his dark army over the open plain. Just as when a cloud blots out the sun and begins to move from mid-ocean towards the land, long-suffering farmers see it in the far distance and shudder to the heart, knowing what it will bring, the ruin of trees, the slaughter of their crops, and destruction everywhere. The flying winds come first, and their sound is first to reach the shore. Just so, the Trojan leader from Rhoeteum drove his army forward against the enemy in wedge formation, each man shoulder to shoulder with his neighbour. Fierce Osiris was struck by the sword of Thymbraeus. Mnestheus cut down Archetius, Achates Apulo, and Gaius Ufens. Tolumnius himself fell, the augur who had been the first to hurl a spear against his enemies. The shouting rose to the sky, and now it was the Rutulians who turned and fled over the fields, raising the dust on their backs. Aeneas did not think it fit to cut down men who had turned away from him, nor did he go after those who stood to meet him in equal combat or carried spears. He was looking for Turnus, and only Turnus, tracking him through the thick murk. Turnus was the only man he asked to fight. Seeing this, and being stricken with fear, the warrior maiden Juturna, Turnus's sister, threw out Metiscus, the driver of Turnus's chariot, from between the reins and left him lying where he fell, far from the chariot pole. She herself took over the reins and whipped them up to make them ripple, the very image of Metiscus in voice and form and armour, like a black swallow flying through the house of some wealthy man and collecting tiny scraps of food and dainties for her young chattering on the nest. Sometimes her twittering is heard in empty colonnades, sometimes round marshy pools. Just so did Juturna ride through the middle of the enemy, and the swift chariot flew all over the field. Now here, now there, she gave glimpses of her brother in triumph. But then she would fly off and not allow him to join in the battle. But Aeneas was no less determined to meet him, and followed his every twist and turn, tracking him and calling his name at the top of his voice all through the scattered lines of battle. Every time he caught sight of his enemy, he tried to match the speed of his wing-footed horses, and every time Juturna swung the chariot round and took to flight. What was Aeneas to do? Conflicting tides seethed in his mind, but no answer came, and different passions drove him to opposing thoughts. Then the nimble Messapus, who was running with two pliant steel-tipped javelins in his left hand, aimed one of them at Aeneas and hurled it true. Aeneas checked himself and crouched on one knee behind his shield, but the flying spear sheared off the peak of his helmet and carried away the plumes from the top of it. At this, his anger rose. Treachery had given him no choice. When he saw Turnus's horses pull the chariot round and withdraw again and again, He called upon Jupiter and the altars of the broken treaty, and then, and not till then, he plunged into the middle of his enemies. He was terrible in his might, and Mars was aiding him. Sparing no man, he roused himself to savage slaughter and gave full rein to his anger. What god could unfold all this bitter suffering for me? What god could express in song all the different ways of death for men and for their leaders, driven back and forth across the plain, now by Turnus, now by Trojan Aeneas? Was it your will, O Jupiter, that peoples who were to live at peace for all time should clash so violently in war? Aeneas met Sucro the Rutulian. This was the first clash to check the Trojan charge, but Sucro did not detain them long. Aeneas caught him in the side and drove the raw steel through the cage of the ribs to the breast, where death comes quickest. Turnus, now on foot, met Diores and his brother Amycus, who had been unhorsed. As Diores rode at him, he struck him with his long spear. Amycus he dispatched with his sword. Then, cutting off both their heads, he hung them from his chariot and carried them along with him, dripping their dew of blood. Aeneas sent Talos, Tanais, and brave Cethegus to their deaths, all three in one encounter. Then the gloomy Onetes, who bore a name linked with Echion of Thebes, and whose mother was Peridia. Turnus killed the brothers who came from the fields of Apollo in Lycia. Then young Menoetes, who hated war, but that did not save him. He was an Arcadian who had plied his art all round the rivers of Lerna, rich in fish. His home was poor, and he never knew the munificence of the great. His father sowed his crops on hired land. Like fires started in different places in a dry wood, or in thickets of crackling laurel, or like foaming rivers roaring as they run down in spate from the high mountains to the sea, sweeping away everything that lies in their path. No more sluggish were Aeneas and Turnus as they rushed over the field of battle. Now, if ever, did the anger seethe within them, now burst their unconquerable hearts, and every wound they gave with all their might. Muranus was sounding the names of his father's fathers, and their fathers before them, his whole lineage through all the kings of Latium, when Aeneas knocked him flying from his chariot with a rock. A huge boulder he sent whirling at him and stretched him out on the ground. The wheels rolled him forward in a tangle of yoke and reins, and his galloping horses had no thought for their master as they trampled him under their clattering hooves. Helus made a wild charge, roaring hideously. But Turnus ran to meet him and spun a javelin at his gilded forehead. Through the helmet it went and stuck in his brain. As for you, Cretheus, bravest of the Greeks, your right hand did not rescue you from Turnus, nor was Cupencus protected by his gods when Aeneas came near. But his breast met the steel, and the bronze shield did not hold back the moment of his death. You too, Aeolus. The Laurentine plains saw you fall, and your back cover a broad measure of their ground. The Greek battalions could not bring you down, nor could Achilles, who overturned the kingdom of Priam. But here you lie. This was the finishing line of your life. Your home was in the hills below Mount Ida, a home in the hills of Lyrnessus. But your grave is in Laurentine soil. The two armies were now wholly turned to face one another. All the Latins and all the Trojans, Mnestheus and bold Serestus, Messapus, tamer of horses, and brave Asilas, the battalion of Etruscans and the Arcadian squadrons of Evander were striving, each man with all his resources of strength and will, waging this immense conflict with no rest and no respite. At that moment, Aeneas's mother, loveliest of the goddesses, put it into his mind to go to the city, to lead his army instantly against the walls and throw the Latins into confusion at this sudden calamity. Turning his eyes this way and that as he tracked down Turnus through all the different battle lines, he noticed the city, untouched by this great war, quiet and unharmed. And his spirit was fired by the sudden thought of a greater battle he could fight. Calling the leaders of the Trojans together, Nestheus, Segestus, and the brave Serestus, he took up position on some rising ground, and the whole of the Trojan legion joined them there in close formation, without laying down their shields or spears. Aeneas addressed them, standing in the middle of a high mound of earth. "There must be no delay in carrying out my commands. Jupiter is on our side. No man must go to work half-heartedly, because my plan is new to him. The city is the cause of this war. It is the very kingdom of Latinus, and if they do not this day agree to submit to the yoke, to accept defeat and to obey, I shall root it out and level its smoking roofs to the ground. Am I to wait until Turnus thinks fit to stand up to me in battle and consents to meet the man who has already defeated him? Oh, my fellow citizens, this city is the head and heart of this wicked war. Bring your torches now, and we shall claim our treaty with fire." When he had finished speaking, they formed a wedge, all of them striving with equal resolve in their hearts, and moved towards the walls in a solid mass. Ladders suddenly appeared. Fire came to hand. They rushed the gates and cut to pieces the first guards that met them. They spun their javelins and darkened the heavens with steel. Aeneas himself, standing among the leaders under the city wall, with his right hand outstretched, lifted up his voice to accuse Latinus, calling the gods to witness that this was the second time he had been forced into battle. Twice already the Italians had shown themselves to be his enemies. This was not the first treaty they had violated. Alarm and discord rose among the citizens. Some wanted the city to be opened up and the gates thrown wide to receive the Trojans, and they even dragged the king himself onto the ramparts. Others caught up their weapons and rushed to defend the walls. Just as when a shepherd tracks some bees to their home, shut well away inside a porous rock, and fills it with acrid smoke, the bees, alarmed for their safety, rush in all directions through their wax-built camp, sharpening their wrath and buzzing fiercely. Then, as the black stench rolls through their chambers, the inside of the rock booms with their blind complaints, and the smoke flies to the empty winds. Weary as they were, a new misfortune now befell the Latins, and shook their whole city to its foundations with grief. As soon as the queen, standing on the palace roof, saw the enemy approaching the city, the walls under attack, fire flying up to the roofs. No Rutulian army anywhere to confront the enemy, and no sign of Turnus's columns. She thought in her misery that he had been killed in the cut and thrust of battle. In that instant, her mind was deranged with grief, and she screamed that she was the cause, the guilty one, the fountainhead of all these evils. Pouring her heart out in sorrow and madness, she resolved to die. Her hand rent her purple robes, and she died a hideous death in the noose of a rope tied to a high beam. When the unhappy women of Latium heard of this, her daughter Lavinia was the first to tear her golden hair and rosy cheeks. The whole household was wild with grief around her, and their lamentations rang all through the palace. From there, the report spread through the whole city, and gloom was everywhere. Latinus went with his garments torn, dazed by the death of his wife and the downfall of his city, fouling his grey hair with handfuls of dirt and dust. Meanwhile, on a distant part of the plain, the warrior Turnus was chasing a few stragglers. He was less vigorous now, and less delighted with the triumphant progress of his horses, when the wind carried to him this sound of shouting and of unexplained terror. He pricked up his ears. It was a confused noise from the city, a murmuring with no hint of joy in it. "What is this?" he cried in wild dismay, pulling on the reins to stop the chariot. "Why such grief and distress on the walls, and all this clamour streaming from every part of the city?" His sister, who was driving the chariot in the shape of Metiscus and had control of the horses and the reins, protested, "This way, Turnus. Let's go after these Trojans. This is where our first victories showed us the way. There are others whose hands can defend the city. Aeneas is bearing hard on Italians in all the confusion of battle. We too can deal out death without pity to Trojans. You will kill as many as he does, and not fall short in the honours of war." Turnus made his reply, "Oh, my sister, I recognised you some time ago, when first you shattered the treaty with your scheming, and engaged in this war, and you do not deceive me now, pretending not to be a goddess. But whose will is it that you have been sent down from Olympus to endure this agony? Was it all to see the cruel death of your pitiable brother? For what am I to do? What stroke of fortune could grant me safety now? No one is left whom I love as much as I loved Murranus, and I have seen him before my own eyes, calling for me as he fell, a mighty warrior laid low by a mighty wound. The luckless Ufens has died rather than look on my disgrace, and the Trojans have his body and his arms. Shall I stand by and see our homes destroyed? This is the one indignity that remained, and shall I not lift my hand to refute the words of Drances? Shall I turn tail? Will this land of Italy see Turnus on the run? Is it so bad a thing to die? Be gracious to me, you gods of the underworld, since the gods above have turned their faces from me. My spirit will come down to you unstained, knowing nothing of such dishonour, and worthy of my great ancestors to the end." Scarcely had he finished speaking when Sarkes suddenly came galloping up on his foaming horse, having ridden through the middle of the enemy with an arrow wound full in his face. On he rushed, calling the name of Turnus and imploring him. "You are our last hope of safety, Turnus. You must take pity on your people. The sword and spear of Aeneas are like the lightning, and he is threatening to throw down the highest citadels of Italy and give them over to destruction. Firebrands are already flying to the roofs. Every Latin face, every Latin eye is turned to you. The king himself is at a loss. Whom should he choose to marry our daughters? What treaties should he turn to? And then the queen, who placed all her trust in you, has taken her own life. Fear overcame her, and she fled the light of day. Alone in front of the gates, Messapus and bold Atinas are holding the line, and all around them on every side stand the battalions of the enemy, in serried ranks. Their drawn swords are a crop of steel bristling in the fields. And you are out here wheeling your chariot in the deserted grasslands. Turnus was thunderstruck, bewildered by the changing shape of his fortune, and stood there dumb and staring. In that one heart of his there seethed a bitter shame, a grief shot through with madness, love driven on by fury, and a consciousness of his own courage. As soon as the shadows lifted from his mind and light returned, he forced his burning eyes round towards the walls, looking back in deep dismay from his chariot at the great city. There, between the stories of a tower, came a tongue of flame, rolling and billowing to the sky. It was taking hold of the tower which he had built himself, putting the wheels under it and fitting the long gangways. "Sister," he said, "the time has come at last. The fates are too strong. You must not delay them any longer. Let us go where God and cruel fortune call me. I am resolved to meet Aeneas in battle. I am resolved to suffer what bitterness there is in death. You will not see me put to shame again. This is madness, but before I die, I beg of you, let me be mad." No sooner had he spoken than he leapt to the ground from his chariot and dashed through all his enemies and their weapons, leaving his sister behind him to grieve as his charge broke through the middle of their ranks. Just as a boulder comes crashing down from the top of a mountain, torn out by gales, washed out by flood water, or loosened by the stealthy passing of the years, it comes down the sheer face with terrific force, an evil mountain of rock, and bounds over the plain, rolling with it woods and flocks and men. So did Turnus crash through the shattered ranks of his enemies towards the walls of the city, where all the ground was wet with shed blood, and the air sang with flying spears. There he made a sign with his hand, and in the same moment he called out in a loud voice, "Enough, Rutulians, put up your weapons, and you too, Latins. Whatever fortune brings is mine. It is better that I should be the one man who atones for this treaty for all of you and settles the matter with the sword." At these words, the armies parted and left a clear space in the middle between them. But when Father Aeneas heard the name of Turnus, he abandoned the walls and the lofty citadel, sweeping aside all delay and breaking off all his works of war. He leapt for joy and clashed his armour with a noise as terrible as thunder. Huge he was as Mount Athos or Mount Eryx or Father Apenninus himself, roaring when the home oaks shimmer on his flanks and delighting to raise his snowy head into the winds. Now at last the Rutulians and the Trojans and all the men of Italy, the defenders guarding the high ramparts and the besiegers pounding the base of the walls with their rams, they all turned their eyes eagerly to see and took the armour off their shoulders. King Latinus himself was amazed at the sight of these two huge heroes born at opposite sides of the earth, coming together to decide the issue by the sword. There, on a piece of open ground in the plain, they threw their spears at long range as they charged, and when they clashed, the bronze of their shields rang out, and the earth groaned. Blow upon blow they dealt with their swords as chance and courage met and mingled in confusion. just as two enemy bulls on the great mountain of Scylla or on top of Tabernus bring their horns to bear and charge into battle. The herdsmen stand back in terror. The herd stands silent and afraid, and the heifers low quietly together, waiting to see who is to rule the grove, who is to be the leader of the whole herd. Meanwhile, the bulls are locked together, exchanging blow upon blow, gouging horn into hide, till their necks and shoulders are awash with blood, and all the grove rings with their lowing and groaning. Just so did Aeneas of Troy and Turnus, son of Daunus, rush together with shields clashing, and the din filled the heavens. Then Jupiter himself lifted up a pair of scales with the tongue centred and put the lives of the two men in them to decide who would be condemned in the ordeal of battle and with whose weight death would descend. Turnus leapt forward, thinking he was safe, and lifting his sword and rising to his full height, he struck with all his strength behind it. The Trojans shouted and the Latins cried out in their anxiety, while both armies watched intently. But in the height of his passion, the treacherous sword broke in mid-blow and left him defenceless, had he not sought help in flight. Faster than the east wind he flew, when he saw his own right hand holding nothing but a sword handle he did not recognise. The story goes that when his horses were yoked, and he was mounting his chariot in headlong haste to begin the battle, he left his father's sword behind, and caught up the sword of his charioteer Metiscus. For some time, while the Trojans were scattered and in flight, that was enough. But when it met the divine armour made by Vulcan, the mortal blade was brittle as an icicle and shattered on impact, leaving its fragments glittering on the golden sand. At this, Turnus fled in despair and tried to escape to another part of the plain, weaving his uncertain course now to this side, now to that, for the Trojans formed a dense barrier around him, hemming him in between a huge marsh and the high walls. Nor did Aeneas let up in his pursuit. Slowed down as he was by the arrow wound, his legs failing him sometimes and unable to run, he was still ablaze with fury and kept hard on the heels of the terrified Turnus, like a hunting dog that happens to trap a stag in the bend of a river or in a ring of red feathers used as a scare, pressing him hard with his running and barking. The stag is terrified by the ambush he is caught in, or by the high river bank. He runs and runs back a thousand ways, but the untiring Umbrian hound stays with him, with jaws gaping. Now he has him, now he seems to have him, and the jaws snap shut, but he is thwarted and bites the empty air. Then, as the shouting rises louder than ever, all the river banks and pools return the sound, and the whole sky thunders with the din. As he ran, Turnus kept shouting at the Rutulians, calling each of them by name, and demanding the sword he knew so well. Aeneas, on the other hand, was threatening instant death and destruction to anyone who came near. Much as that alarmed them, he terrified them even more by threatening to raze their city to the ground, and though he was wounded, he did not slacken in his pursuit. Five times round they ran in one direction, five times they rewound the circle, for this was no small prize they were trying to win at games. What they were competing for was the lifeblood of Turnus. It so chanced that a bitter-leaved wild olive tree had stood on this spot, sacred to Faunus and long revered by sailors. On it, men saved from storms at sea used to nail their offerings to the Laurentine god and dedicate the clothes they had vowed for their safety. But the Trojans, making no exception for the sacred tree trunk, had removed it to clear space for the combat. In this stump, the spear of Aeneas was now embedded. The force of his throw had carried it here and lodged it fast in the tough wood of the root. He strained at it and tried to pull it out so that he could hunt with a missile the quarry he could not catch on foot. Wild now with fear, Turnus cried, "Pity me, I beg of you, Faunus, and you, good Mother Earth, hold on to that spear. If I have always paid you those honours which Aeneas and his men have profaned in war." So he prayed, and he did not call for the help of the god in vain. Aeneas was long delayed, struggling with the stubborn stump, and no strength of his could prise open the bite of the wood. While he was heaving and straining with all his might, the goddess Juturna, daughter of Daunus, changed once more into the shape of the charioteer Metiscus, ran forward to give Turnus his sword. Venus was indignant that the nymph was allowed to be so bold, so she came and wrenched out Aeneas's spear from deep in the root. Then these glorious warriors, their weapons and their spirits restored to them, one relying on his sword, the other towering and formidable behind his spear, stood there breathing hard, ready to engage in the contest of war. Meanwhile, the king of all-powerful Olympus saw Juno watching the battle from a golden cloud and spoke these words to her. "Oh, my dear wife, what will be the end of this? What is there left for you to do? You yourself know, and admit that you know, that Aeneas is a god of this land, and that he has a right to heaven, and is fated to be raised to the stars. What are you scheming? What do you hope to achieve by perching there in these chilly clouds? Was it right that a god should suffer violence and be wounded by the hand of a mortal? Was it right that Turnus should be given back the sword that was taken from him? For what could Juturna have done without your help? Why have you put strength into the arm of the defeated? The time has come at last for you to cease and give way to our entreaties. Do not let this great sorrow gnaw at your heart in silence, and do not make me listen to grief and resentment forever streaming from your sweet lips. The end has come. You have been able to harry the Trojans by sea and by land, to light the fires of an unholy war, to soil a house with sorrow, and mix the sound of mourning with the marriage song. I forbid you to go further." These were the words of Jupiter. With bowed head, the goddess Juno, daughter of Saturn, made this reply. "Because I have known your will, great Jupiter, against my own wishes, I have abandoned Turnus and abandoned the earth. But for your will, you would not be seeing me sitting alone in mid-air on a cloud, suffering whatever is sent to me to suffer. I would be clothed in fire, standing close into the line of battle and dragging Trojans into bloody combat. It was I admit it, who persuaded Juturna to come to the help of her unfortunate brother, and with my blessing to show greater daring for the sake of his life. But not to shoot arrows, not to stretch the bow. I swear it by the implacable fountainhead of the river Styx, the one oath which binds the god of heaven. And now I, Juno, yield and quit these battles which I so detest. But I entreat you, for the sake of Latium and the honour of your own kin, to allow what the law of fate does not forbid. When at last their marriages are blessed, I offer no obstruction. When at last they come together in peace and make their laws and treaties together, do not command the Latins to change their ancient name in their own land, to become Trojans and to be called Teucrians. They are men. Do not make them change their voice or native dress. Let there be Latium. Let the Alban kings live on from generation to generation, and the stock of Rome be made mighty by the manly courage of Italy. Troy has fallen. Let it lie, Troy and the name of Troy. He who devised mankind and all the world smiled and replied, "You are the true sister of Jupiter and the second child of Saturn. Such waves of anger do you set rolling from deep in your heart. But come now, lay aside this fury that arose in vain. I grant what you wish. I yield. I relent of my own free will. The people of Ausonia will keep the tongue of their fathers and their ancient ways. As their name is, so shall it remain. The Trojans will join them in body only, and will then be submerged. Ritual I will give, and the modes of worship, and I will make them all Latins, speaking one tongue. You will see that the people who arise from this admixture of Ausonian blood will be above all men, above the gods, in devotion, and no other race will be their equals in paying you honour." Juno nodded in assent. She rejoiced and forced her mind to change, leaving the cloud behind her and withdrawing from the sky. This done, the father of the gods pondered another task in his mind and prepared to dismiss Juturna from her brother's side. "There are two monsters named Deirai, born to the goddess of the dead of night, in one and the same litter with Megaera of Tartarus. The heads of all three she bound with coiling snakes and gave them wings to ride the wind. These attend the throne of savage Jupiter in his royal palace and sharpen the fears of suffering mortals whenever the king of the gods sets plagues or hideous deaths in motion, or terrifies guilty cities by the visitation of war. One of these, Jupiter sent swiftly down from the heights of heaven, with orders to confront Juturna as an omen. She flew to earth, carried in a swift whirlwind, like an arrow going through a cloud, spun from the bowstring of a Parthian who has armed the barb with a virulent poison for which there is no cure. A Parthian, or a Cretan from Cydonia. And it whirs as it flies unseen through the swift darkness. So flew the daughter of night, making for the earth. When she saw the Trojan battle lines and the army of Turnus, she took in an instant the shape of the little bird which perches on tombs and the gables of empty houses, and sings late its ill-omened song among the shades of night. In this guise the monster flew again and again at Turnus's face, screeching and beating his shield with her wings. A strange numbness came over him, and his bones melted with fear. His hair stood on end, and the voice stuck in his throat. His sister Juturna recognised the Deira from a long way off by the whirring of her wings and grieved. She loosened and tore her hair. She scratched her face and beat her breast, crying, "What can your sister do to help you now, Turnus? Much have I endured, but nothing now remains for me, and I have no art that could prolong your life. How can I set myself against such a portent? At last, I leave the battle. Do not frighten me, you birds of evil omen. I am already afraid. I know the beating of your wings and the sound of death. I do not fail to understand the proud commands of great-hearted Jupiter. Is this his reward for my lost virginity? For what purpose has he granted me eternal life? Why has he deprived me of the state of death? But for that, I could at least have put an end to my suffering and borne my poor brother company through the shades. So this is immortality. Will anything that is mine be sweet to me without you, my brother? Is there no abyss that can open deep enough to take a goddess down to the deepest of the shades? At these words, covering her head in a blue-green veil and moaning bitterly, the goddess plunged into the depths of her own river. Aeneas kept pressing his pursuit with his huge spear flashing as long as a tree, and these were the words he spoke in his anger. What is the delay now? Why are you still shirking, Turnus? This is not a race. It is a fight with dangerous weapons at close quarters. Turn yourself into any shape you like. Scrape together all your resources of spirit and skill. Pray to sprout wings and fly to the stars of heaven, or shut yourself up and hide in a hole in the ground. Turnus replied, shaking his head. You are fierce, Aeneas, but wild words do not frighten me. It is the gods that cause me to fear, the gods and the enmity of Jupiter. He said no more, but looked round and saw a huge rock, a huge and ancient rock which happened to be lying on the plain, a boundary stone put there to settle a dispute about land. 12 picked men, like those the earth now produces, could scarcely lift it up onto their shoulders. But he caught it up in his trembling hands and, rising to his full height and running at speed, he hurled it at his enemy. But he had no sense of running or going, of lifting or moving the huge rock. His knees gave way. His blood chilled and froze, and the stone rolled away under its own impetus over the open ground between them. But it did not go the whole way, and it did not strike its target. Just as when we are asleep, when in the weariness of night, rest lies heavy on our eyes, we dream we are trying desperately to run further and not succeeding, till we fall exhausted in the middle of our efforts. The tongue is useless. The strength we know we have fails our body. We have no voice, no words to obey our will. So it was with Turnus. Wherever his courage sought a way, the dread goddess barred his progress. During these moments, the thoughts whirled in his brain. He gazed at the Rutulians and the city. He faltered with fear. He began to tremble at the death that was upon him. He could see nowhere to run, no way to come at his enemy, no chariot anywhere, no sister to drive it. As he faltered, the deadly spear of Aeneas flashed. His eyes had picked the spot, and he threw from long range with all his weight behind the throw. Stones hurled by siege artillery never roar like this. The crash of the bursting thunderbolt is not so loud. Like a dark whirlwind, it flew, carrying death and destruction with it, piercing the outer rings of the sevenfold shield and laying open the lower rim of the breastplate. It went whistling through the middle of the thigh. When the blow struck, down went great Turnus, bending his knee to the ground. The Rutulians rose with a groan which echoed round the whole mountain, and far and wide the high forests sent back the sound of their voices. He lowered his eyes and stretched out his right hand to beg as a suppliant. "I have brought this upon myself," he said, "and for myself I ask nothing. Make use of what fortune has given you, but if any thought of my unhappy father can touch you, I beg of you, and you too had such a father in Anchises, take pity on the old age of Daunus, and give me back to my people. Or, if you prefer it, give them back my dead body. You have defeated me, and the men of Ausonia have seen me defeated and stretching out my hands to you. Lavinia is yours. Do not carry your hatred any further." There stood Aeneas, deadly in his armour, rolling his eyes. But he checked his hand, hesitating more and more as the words of Turnus began to move him, when suddenly his eyes caught the fatal baldric of the boy Pallas, high on Turnus's shoulder, with the glittering studs he knew so well. Turnus had defeated and wounded him, and then killed him, and now he was wearing his belt on his shoulder as a battle honour taken from an enemy. Aeneas feasted his eyes on the sight of this spoil, this reminder of his own wild grief. Then, burning with mad passion and terrible in his wrath, he cried, "Are you to escape me now, wearing the spoils stripped from the body of those I loved? By this wound which I now give, it is Pallas who makes sacrifice of you. It is Pallas who exacts the penalty in your guilty blood." Blazing with rage, he plunged the steel full into his enemy's breast. The limbs of Turnus were dissolved in cold, and his life left him with a groan, fleeing in anger down to the shades.